If you want to know what actually keeps Australian financial regulators awake at night, I mean, it isn't the big banks.
Right, surprisingly enough.
Yeah, it's actually this group of independent professionals who just, well, quietly swallowed up 77.3% of the entire national mortgage market.
Which is just a staggering number when you really
I
think
mean, it
about it.
really is. I mean, we are talking about a scenario where three quarters of the single largest financial transaction most citizens will ever make, is now flowing through one specific distribution channel.
Exactly.
So today we are digging into an incredibly timely piece of source material for this deep dive. It's from the Broker Times, published on June 8th, 2026, by Jennifer Austin.
Great piece.
Yeah, it really is. It's titled Record Share Rising Scrutiny: What 77.3% Broker Penetration Really Signals. And it asks this rather dangerous question, like, what actually happens when you win a market so completely that you transform from, a successful service provider into a systemic economic risk?
Right, because that transition from being just a participant to becoming actual infrastructure, well, that's the core tension we are unpacking
Not
today.
sure.
We are looking at a level of market penetration that most industries, they spend decades trying to achieve, only to find out that the reward for absolute dominance is, well, absolute surveillance.
Which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive for you today. So whether you are, say, a finance professional prepping for your next quarterly strategy meeting, or you're just, someone who is insanely curious and fascinated by market dynamics, this is for you.
Absolutely.
Because we are going to explore the hidden dangers of becoming too successful in business. We want to look at why a record-breaking market share triggers such intense regulatory heat and map out the specific strategies brokers have to use to survive and thrive in this new landscape.
Yeah, you really have to adapt.
So let's start with the sheer scale of this reality. According to the Mortgage and Finance Association of Australia, their data says mortgage brokers were at 77.3% of all new home loans in the September 2025 quarter. Right. And just 2 years prior, so in September 2023, that number was 71.5%.
That is a massive leap.
It is a jump of nearly 6 percentage points in just 24 months.
I mean, okay, let's unpack this because hitting 77.3% market share is like it's like a local indie band suddenly selling out stadiums worldwide.
That's a great way to look at it.
It's a massive win, but it means you just cannot operate under the radar anymore. So, what is the actual mechanism driving people away from the banks and toward these brokers?
Well, you have to look at the macroeconomic conditions, the pressure cooker that borrowers are sitting in right now. I mean, the source text points really heavily to the 4.35% cash rate.
Oh, yeah, that
It
hurts.
does. When central banks hold the cash rate that high, it creates this immediate agonizing squeeze on anyone with a variable rate mortgage. So borrowers aren't just, casually looking for a slightly better deal.
Right, they're in panic mode. Exactly. They're experiencing severe payment shock. They are forced to refinance just to literally keep their heads above water. And simultaneously, the banks themselves, well, they tighten their lending criteria because the overall economic environment is just riskier.
So credit becomes incredibly difficult to actually secure.
Exactly.
So the old days of just, walking down to your local childhood bank branch, sitting with the manager and getting a loan approved over a cup of coffee, I mean, those days are entirely dead.
Oh, completely gone. The consumer is navigating this maze where the walls just keep moving. So, what do? They actively seek out what the major aggregator groups call trusted professionals.
Right, they need a guide.
Yes, a dedicated guide who understands the internal logic of, like, 40 different lenders. And what's fascinating here is how that desperation for guidance translates into monumental capital flow.
Like the numbers at the top end.
Right. The article highlights that Aussie reclaimed the number one brokerage position, settling over $28.07 billion in the 2025 financial year alone.
Billion with a B.
With a B.
I mean, that is an almost incomprehensible volume of money moving through a third-party channel. But, if I'm a broker reading this article, I'm probably popping champagne right now. Yet Jennifer Austin is essentially waving a massive red warning flag.
She definitely is.
Why is 77.3% a problem?
So think of it like a national power grid. When brokers facilitated, say, 20 or 30% of the market, they were basically like individual homeowners installing solar panels on their roofs.
Okay, I'm with you.
If one solar panel breaks, or even if a whole neighborhood's panels are installed wrong, it's a localized problem. It does not threaten the city.
Right, the lights stay on for everyone else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at nearly 80% market share, brokers are no longer the solar panels. They are the power grid itself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and if there is a fundamental flaw in how the grid operates, the entire national economy goes dark. And regulators, well, they do not ignore the power grid.
That makes the shift in perspective so much clearer. When you become the grid, the government suddenly wants to, you know, inspect all your wiring. And the author argues that because dominance naturally invites this kind of microscopic attention, there are three specific areas, she calls them three vectors, where regulators and competitors are aiming their lasers right now.
Right.
Let's break down the mechanics of the first one, remuneration.
Yeah, so remuneration is simply the architecture of how a broker gets paid. And in this industry, it's traditionally split into a few different mechanisms.
Okay.
First, you have the upfront commission. That's a percentage of the loan amount paid by the bank to the broker when the loan finally settles. Then there's the trailing commission.
Which is like an ongoing payment, right?
Right, a smaller ongoing percentage paid every single month for the life of the loan, assuming the borrower doesn't default or leave. Yeah. And then finally, there are clawbacks.
Oh, clawbacks. That's when a broker actually has to return their commission to the bank, right? Like if the borrower refinances or pays off the loan too quickly, usually within the first 2 years or so.
You've got it. And for a long time, these were just treated as, you know, behind-the-scenes contractual details between banks and brokers. But at nearly 80% market penetration, those pay structures become mainstream public policy issues.
Because there's so much money involved.
Exactly. Regulators look at an upfront commission and ask, like, does this incentivize the broker to encourage the client to borrow way more money than they actually need just to inflate their own payday?
Right.
And they look at clawbacks and ask, does the fear of losing that commission stop a broker from helping a client refinance to a better deal a year later? The source text specifically notes that the recent shifts in debates around clawback policies, well, they prove these settings are not frozen.
So regulators can and will change them if they think consumers are getting hurt.
Absolutely.
Which naturally brings us to the second vector, which is intimately tied to consumer protection, conduct, and the best interest duty. And here we are really talking about ASIC, the corporate regulator. They are the ones patrolling this beat.
Yes. ASIC enforces the best interests duty, or BI as it's called. This is a relatively recent legal requirement, and it explicitly forces mortgage brokers to act in the best interests of the consumer.
Over their own profits.
Exactly. Prioritizing the consumer's financial well-being above the broker's or even the aggregator's profit. And as the channel's volume just explodes, ASIC's interest in how brokers handle complaints, how they do their internal file audits, and whether they are genuinely fulfilling that duty, it grows exponentially.
They want to know if the sheer speed of business is making people sloppy.
That's it, exactly. Is the quality of advice slipping because everyone's too busy?
Right. Well, let's look at the third vector, because this one introduces a phrase that frankly always sparks debate: competition and channel power. The source mentions all these questions arising around vertical integration.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Just to ground us in the mechanics for a second, aggregators are the large umbrella companies that group independent brokers together, right? They provide the software, the compliance support, access to the lender panels. And vertical integration happens when those aggregator companies are actually owned by or really deeply tied to the major banks themselves.
And that structure right there creates a massive headache for competition watchers. I mean, think about it. If a distribution channel is writing 77% of all loans, and the company providing the software and the lender panel to those brokers is literally owned by Bank X,
a regulator is immediately going to start asking questions.
Exactly. Are they genuinely scanning the whole market for the best deal? Or is the aggregator software, you know, subtly funneling loans toward Bank X?
Right.
The article is very careful to point out that regulators aren't necessarily alleging active corruption, but just the sheer scale of the channel makes these questions of systemic bias inevitable.
Okay, hold on. Let's pause here, because I'm looking at these three vectors: pay structures, conduct, and bank ownership. And here's where it gets really interesting for me. I have to challenge this underlying premise of imminent danger.
Okay, let's hear it.
If a distribution channel is facilitating almost three quarters of the country's loans, I mean, the market has clearly spoken, right?
Sure.
Consumers clearly prefer using brokers over going direct to a bank. So doesn't that effectively make the broker channel, quote unquote, too big to fail? Like, why would regulators actively mess with a system that is obviously delivering exactly what the public demands?
It is a really tempting way to view the landscape. But relying on that assumption is incredibly dangerous for a business owner right now. The source material counters that exact logic with this concept called the shield versus the exposure.
Oh, I like that. Unpack the mechanics of that for me. How can scale be an exposure if it just proves consumer preference?
Okay, so your argument about being too big to fail, that is the shield. You are absolutely right that you cannot dismantle a channel writing 77% of the nation's mortgages without causing just a catastrophic freeze in the housing market.
Right, it would be chaos.
Total chaos. So that volume acts as a protective shield against the industry being wiped out entirely. But, and here's the catch, that exact same scale is the exposure.
Yeah. Because they can't ignore you.
Exactly. Because you are so systemically integral to the economy, you attract continuous, rigorous, heavily funded surveillance. Regulators don't investigate systems because they want to destroy them. They investigate them constantly to ensure they don't blow up the wider economy.
Wow, okay.
The sheer size guarantees the Brokey Channel will never, ever be left alone to self-regulate again.
So massive volume buys you survival, but it basically costs you your privacy.
Perfectly said.
And that transitions perfectly into what Jennifer Austin identifies as the complacency trap. We are moving from the macro threats, you know, the government regulators, to the micro threats sitting right inside a broker's actual office.
Right.
The idea here is that the headline number, that 77.3% aggregate market share, it can create this illusion that masks severe margin pressure at the individual business level. It's like riding a rising tide and just mistaking it for your boat getting bigger.
That is exactly it. It is the fundamental difference between revenue and profit. I mean, high market volume means the phone is ringing, deals are settling, which is fantastic for top line revenue. But the cost of doing business is also skyrocketing.
Right. Compliance takes way longer.
Technology costs more, staff are more expensive. A broker might be settling, say, 30% more loans than they did 3 years ago, but their actual take-home profit margin on each of those loans could be shrinking.
It's like running a restaurant that is packed to the doors every single night so you feel like this massive success. But if the cost of your ingredients and your wait staff has doubled, I mean, you might actually be losing money on every plate you serve. High volume just masks a structurally broken business model.
That is the exact trap. And the industry really should recognize this danger because, well, they have already lived through a version of it. The article actually invokes the ghost of the Financial Services Royal Commission.
Right. And for our listeners outside Australia or, you know, anyone who just needs a quick refresher, the Royal Commission was this massive sweeping public inquiry into misconduct in the financial services sector a few years ago.
Yes. And it was an absolute existential moment for mortgage brokers.
Mm-hmm.
The commission put broker remuneration, specifically that concept of trailing commissions we talked about, under a blinding national spotlight. They floated major recommendations that could have entirely dismantled how brokers get paid.
But the industry survived that, right? They rallied, they introduced the best interest duty, and they basically won back public trust. So hasn't that storm already passed?
The storm passed, yeah. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it established a permanent blueprint for how quickly the weather can change. The author points out that the fundamental difference between the Royal Commission era and 2026 is the scale.
Because they're so much bigger now.
Exactly. If a new public conversation starts today about tweaking how brokers are paid, the policy machinery can move incredibly fast because the systemic impact is just so much greater now.
Which leads us to the operational reality, because surviving a regulatory inquiry is one thing, but maintaining that really rigorous client-first conduct while your office is processing record-breaking volumes of work, that is entirely different.
Oh, for sure.
Doing the right thing on 10 files a month is standard. But doing the right thing perfectly with flawless documentation on 50 files a month while the phone is just ringing off the hook, that is where a business fractures.
Which brings us to the actionable part of the source material, because recognizing the threat is totally useless without a strategy to insulate your business.
Right.
The author provides a 5-point resilience map. And these are not just, you know, abstract theories. They are mechanical changes a broker must implement to build a weatherproof practice.
Okay, let's run through these mechanics. Point one, make best interests duty evidence your license to operate. What does that actually look like for a broker on, say, a random Tuesday afternoon?
It means shifting your mindset from just doing the right thing to proving the right thing. It is the concept of audit grade file notes.
Audit grade?
Yes. If an ASIC investigator pulls a client file, they should not need to call the broker into the room to explain why they recommended a specific 30-year fixed loan from a specific mid-tier bank.
The document has to stand on its own.
Exactly. The document itself must tell the entire logical story. It has to detail the client's goals, the options considered, and the exact mechanical reason why this specific product was chosen above all others to serve the client's best interests. If it isn't documented clearly in the eyes of the regulator, it simply never happened.
That is brutal, but makes sense. Now, point two on the resilience map is to build value beyond rate, because pure price comparison, just finding the lowest interest rate, is incredibly vulnerable to technology.
Oh, absolutely.
If your entire value proposition is finding a 4.35% rate instead of a 4.4% rate, an algorithm is eventually going to replace you for free.
Yep.
But the author argues that advice, structuring, and problem solving resist automation. Now, let me push back on this a bit. The article includes this concept called the record share resilience read. It's essentially two sliders to help brokers self-assess. One slider measures how dependent their revenue is on standard residential loans, and the other measures how deep their actual advice goes. So an 80% dependence on residential pay versus only a 50% depth in advice.
Right.
But if a borrower walks through the door and they are completely panicked by the cost of living and they are solely aggressively fixated on getting the absolute cheapest possible rate, how does a broker genuinely prove their value is beyond rate? How do you avoid just becoming a human comparison website?
That's a great question. You prove it by managing the journey, not just pointing to the destination. I mean, a comparison website can show you a cheap rate in 2 seconds. But in a high rate, tight credit environment, actually securing an approval for that rate is a highly stressful, incredibly complex journey.
Because the banks are actively looking for reasons to say no right now.
Exactly. A human broker reviews the client's entire financial picture before the bank ever even sees it. They might spot, for instance, that the client's credit card limits are too high, which will trigger an automatic algorithmic rejection from the bank, even if the cards have a zero balance.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't have known that.
Right. So the broker tells the client to lower those limits first. They structure the application to maximize the probability of a first-time approval. They provide emotional steadying when the bank inevitably comes back and asks for a fourth month of payslips.
Right.
That proactive problem solving, that emotional anchor during a terrifying financial transaction, that is the value beyond the rate. The algorithm cannot hold your hand when the valuation on your house comes in $10,000 lower than expected.
That makes a lot of sense. It's the difference between a map and a guide.
Exactly.
Okay, point three on the resilience map is where it gets very corporate. Stress test against a remuneration change. Now, stress testing sounds like something a massive multinational bank does. What does that actually look like for a small local brokerage?
It is a mathematical reality check. You literally open up your business's spreadsheet, and you model out a scenario where regulators certainly cap upfront commissions by, say, 20%. Or they abolish trailing commissions entirely for new loans.
No.
Yeah, it hurts. You plug those reduced numbers into your cash flow projection and ask, can you still pay your staff? Can you still pay your commercial lease?
Mm.
It is a deeply uncomfortable exercise, but it reveals exactly where your revenue vulnerabilities lie before the regulator ever makes a move.
Which feeds directly into point four, professionalize deliberately. I'm churning through the next deal, right?
No, totally. Just ride the wave.
Key, but the author is arguing that resilient practices use the boom times to build the boring stuff.
Hmm.
Repeatable operational processes, rigorous staff training, and a brand that stands for more than just transactional speed.
Because if your process is entirely dependent on the primary broker working 80-hour weeks just to keep up, the business isn't resilient. It is just a burnout waiting to happen. Which brings us to the final mechanical defense. Point five, diversify revenue.
This honestly seems like the most critical hedge against regulatory risk.
It absolutely is. The article stresses that relying entirely on a single asset class, so the residential pay model, is a massive exposure. If regulators tweak the rules on home loans, your entire cash flow takes a hit.
So what are resilient brokers doing?
They are actively expanding their licenses and their skills to write asset finance, things like car and equipment loans, or commercial finance for small businesses. They are building structured referral networks with accountants and financial planners. They are creating non-correlated revenue streams.
Right. So if the residential housing market takes a sudden shock, the commercial finance wing of the business keeps the lights on.
Exactly.
You are building multiple pillars under the roof instead of relying on one massive column. So to bring all of this together, the article leaves the industry with three very uncomfortable questions to chew on.
Let's go there.
Number one, if commission structures changed materially tomorrow, would my business survive the next 6 months? Number two, What is my true quantifiable value beyond what a free comparison website can do? And number three, would a random regulatory audit of 10 of my files pass with flying colors without me in the room to explain them?
And honestly, answering those three questions honestly is the mechanical difference between running a fragile business, riding a volume wave, and building a genuinely resilient practice that can survive any regulatory weather.
Absolutely. The ultimate takeaway from the Broker Times is stark. The distribution battle is over. The brokers won. But the next contest is defending the license to actually keep that victory.
Right.
And for you listening, the lesson here extends far beyond the Australian housing market. Because in any industry, achieving dominance, hitting that 77.3% is not the finish line. It is a completely new starting line.
That's a great point.
Dominance changes the rules of the game. It invites microscopic scrutiny from the powers that be, and it requires you to prove your right to exist all over again with far less margin for error.
It is a universal law of scale. And, you know, it leaves us with one final really fascinating thought to consider about the future of professional services in general.
Oh.
Think about it. If technology, algorithms, and AI can eventually replicate the pure price finding and data processing aspects of almost any market.
Right.
And if regulatory compliance continues to aggressively standardize everyday procedures, what happens to the messy human element?
Oh, wow.
Will human empathy, the ability to emotionally steady a client during a panic, and creative, nuanced problem solving, will that transition from being just a standard service expectation into becoming the most highly paid premium luxury in the financial world? Like, does perfect frictionless automation actually make genuine, messy human advice far more valuable?
That is a phenomenal question to ponder as you navigate your own industry. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden costs of industry dominance. Keep asking the hard questions, keep looking past the headline numbers, and we will catch you on the next one.